Turn in your Bibles to Ecclesiastes chapter 1. Ecclesiastes is right after Proverbs and it's right before Song of Solomon's. So turn to Ecclesiastes and we will read the first 11 verses very soon. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, we'll read verses 1 through 11. But first, let's play a little make-believe, shall we? Mr. Rogers is famous for saying, "You can think about things and make believe. All you have to do is think and they will grow." There's something intriguing about little kids beginning to develop their imaginations. Suddenly the family room can become a zoo or a battlefield or a palace or an airplane or a tea party. The world of let's pretend allows kids to actually cultivate an understanding of the real world. So kids become pretend characters, enjoying pretend food at a party, or having pretend conversations with pretend friends, or playing pretend sports on a pretend field. But of course, real life is often very, very different than pretend life. In the real store, you can't just buy whatever you want. In the real hospital, people are actually in pain, and you can't make everyone better. In the real world, making amends in a conflict is sometimes very, very difficult. Real tears take longer to dry. Real frustration takes longer to appease. Real peace takes longer to attain. And while we are not toddlers in this room, sometimes we adults live like they do. Sometimes we live in a pretend world, a world where death or cancer or hardship or accountability or harsh circumstances aren't really real. I mean, they are maybe strange interruptions in our existence, but they're not normal. We are far from those evils. We are above them here in the 21st century. We are free to live our best lives now. We have all the resources we want. We are in control. We are invincible. But friends, this is all just a mirage, isn't it? The book of Ecclesiastes is God's gift to us to help us live in the real world. It blows up our make-believe games. It sort of jolts us into realizing that everything isn't as clean as our make-believe world suggests. Ecclesiastes acts kind of like spiritual smelling salts. You know, you bring it to your head and your heart, and you start to read it, and all of a sudden you kind of wake up to reality as God sees it. This is what happens when you read this rather strange but wonderful book. And so with that, let's read the first 11 verses. The words of the teacher, son of David, king in Jerusalem. Absolute futility, says the teacher. Absolute futility. Everything is futile. What does a person gain for all his efforts that he labors at under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun sets. Panting, it hurries back to the place where it rises, gusting to the south, turning to the north, turning goes the wind, and the wind returns in its cycles. All the streams flow to the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome, more than anyone can say. The eye is not satisfied by seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Can one say about anything, "Look, this is new"? It has already existed in the ages before us. There is no remembrance of those who came before, and of those who will come after, there will also be no remembrance by those who follow them. This is God's holy and inspired word. Thanks be to God. So friends, what is real life like? Not make-believe life, not pretend life. How should we think about real life? The teacher here begins to answer this very question by describing real life in two ways. Let me point those ways out to you. Before we keep going, I wanted to kind of draw your attention to a couple things. First of all, the pastor's book table has a couple resources. First of all, here's a good commentary. It's one of the resources I've used. It's called The Message of Ecclesiastes. It's by Derek Kidner. You'll find that at the pastor book table. You'll notice in your notes on the right side, sermon notes, on the bottom, you'll see some other resources. I want to draw your attention to that. I'll be using those resources throughout the series. So David Gibson's work, Brian Borgman's book, and also the teaching of Greg Gilbert. So these are some resources that I've been using as I've been studying this book, and I want to commend them to you as well. So here's the first description of real life according to the teacher. Life is elusive. Now, this opening section is introductory in nature. It introduces the main themes of the whole book in a very brief 11 verses. And it begins this kind of one-man play. So you've got this narrator who kind of introduces the whole book and the teacher and the characters and the main themes. And that's in this section. And then really the teacher himself takes over and starts to speak personally to us. We'll see that next week and following. And then at the end of Ecclesiastes, chapter 12, starting in verse 9, we see the narrator comes back and he starts to summarize what we've heard from the teacher, kind of bring everything home. In this chapter, what do we see? Well, we learn about the teacher in verse 1. Notice that he is the son of David. He's king in Jerusalem. I believe, as Dr. Giroux mentioned earlier this morning, that he is Solomon, and there's reasons for that I'm not going to get into right now. Then notice the teacher's main conviction is in verse 2. So here's his thesis in verse 2. The principal question that he wrestles with is then found in verse 3. And then verse 4, we see his initial answer. And the rest of the text begins to unpack that answer, verses 5 through 11. So let's look, first of all, at the teacher's main conviction. Verse 2, absolute futility, says the teacher. Absolute futility. Everything is futile. Now, I have a little frustration with this translation and most English translations. The word in Hebrew is hebel. In fact, I want to teach you guys this word, so I want you to repeat after me, hebel. Hebel, okay? So I'm going to say that a lot this week and probably in the following weeks. And how we think about hebel sets the course for how we understand this whole book. It literally means a vapor or a mist or a breath or a wisp of smoke. It's not saying that everything is meaningless or futile or vanity. It is saying that life is the merest of breaths. Everything is but a breath. Think about other passages which also teach this very thing. So we heard in the call to worship, Psalm 144, verse 4 says, a human is like a breath, like vapor. Psalm 39, verses 4 and 5, every human being stands as only a breath, a vapor. James chapter 4, verse 14, you are like vapor that appears for a while, then vanishes. Proverbs 31, verse 30, charm is deceptive and beauty is fleeting. It's vapor. It's hebel. Same word. Joan Collins once said that the problem with beauty is that it's like being born rich and then becoming poor. Beauty is hebel. It's vapor. It's going to be fleeting. What happens when you blow out a candle? You know, how long does that smoke, that little bit of smoke last? Well, it's not very long. You can see it, in fact, disappear right before your eyes within a few seconds. Well, beauty is here one moment and it's gone the next. We are here one minute and we're gone the next. That's what hebel means. Life is unforgivably short. Our lives come and they go without permanent impact or lasting impressions on this world. This is the orbit of hebel. Okay, I think we all encounter this, these feelings that seem to kind of intrude and interrupt our make-believe world. Let me give you an example. I'm in the car. This is a few months ago, and I'm driving to Mars Hill Academy, and I've got my 12-year-old in the car that's rather precocious, and she asks me the question, hey, what's college like? And I'm like, well, okay. So I start to share some stories, and my mind kind of drifts to Emma heading off to college, and it hits me like an ocean wave. I think to myself, man, there she is, you know, about to enter middle school here, and it seems like just yesterday that she was crawling in a onesie and she was babbling and so forth. Before I know it, she's going to be in college, and then she's going to be married, and then she's going to have babies. Now that is a sobering, misty moment for Godwin in the car. The emotions, the thoughts, the fears, even this sense of depression, it has a name. It's called Hebel. Or when I think about my dad, who many of you know passed away about 15 years ago, suddenly from a heart attack. He was 58 years old. Thoughts often flood my mind, really, most weeks. Yeah, he would have been such a great grandfather. You know, I'm getting old too. One day my kids are going to bury me. And this kind of wave of melancholy starts to overwhelm me. Where's the time gone? I will never get that time back. Indeed, my life is a mere breath. David Gerald, the American author and playwright, says, quote, "Life is hard, then you die, then they throw dirt in your face, and then worms eat you. Be grateful that it happens in that order." We're born, we live, we die, and it all happens so quickly, doesn't it? So suddenly, nothing seems to last. So Hebel is for everybody. Nobody escapes it. Whether you're a Christian, whether you're not a Christian, you can love God, you can hate God. You experience this sort of vaporish life. Faith doesn't make the fog of Hebel go away. And the point of Ecclesiastes is not how to get around Hebel, but rather how to cope with it and live within it, knowing there is a God who loves his people. And here's the other thing that is noteworthy as we're kind of beginning our journey here. Hebel is from God. When Adam and Eve sinned, they threw this whole world into a world of Hebel. It's the graffiti written all over this fallen, cursed world. God controls it. It's a condition of judgments. And so as we experience these Hebel moments, whatever it might look like for you, maybe it's a sad or disappointing moment one day, or maybe it's a happy moment, but it's fleeting. It's just kind of like that smoke. It's here one second, and then it's gone the next. Well, we need to view these moments, all of them, as short chapters in a short life within life in a fallen world. This is the way God intends it to be. This is a pill we must swallow. And I think there's a temptation we all face to think that this life will give us ultimate satisfaction and meaning, that we can kind of squeeze as much out of this life as possible such that we are going to be satisfied in some manner. But take a look again at verse 3. What does a person gain for all his efforts that he labors at under the sun? Now, life under the sun is the life of the real world, the fallen world, the world that we all live in today. Now, that word gain, you notice that word gain? You can underline it or circle it if you want, if you write in your Bibles. We'll see that a lot through the book of Ecclesiastes. It's an economic term that essentially means surplus. What's left over? When all is said and done, what will be left over for you in your life? What will you gain at the end of your life? After all the toil and labor and the blood and the sweat and the tears, will you have something to take away? And the implication here as we're kind of continuing on is the answer that the teacher gives is not really. The teacher is telling us, don't try to mine this life looking for ultimate meaning and joy. Don't try to squeeze out of life something it was not ever designed to give you. How much is ever enough? That's a question that Rockefeller was asked at one point. He was the richest man in the world. And do you remember his answer? He says, just a little more. Just a little more. This life cannot satisfy you or me. You cannot have enough friends to satisfy your relational ache. You cannot have enough money to satisfy your sense of security. You cannot have enough success to satisfy your sense of identity. This fallen world is not designed to give those things to you in an ultimate sort of way. So why look for it in this world? That's what the teacher is getting at. Vapor gives us not only a sense of the shortness of life, but its elusiveness, right? You can't put smoke in your pocket. You can't get your hands around, you know, vapor. It's real, it's physical, but it dodges your fingers as you get near it. And yet, we live as if we're in control, don't we? We live like we're in control. The teacher's reminding us here, we can't control this life. Friends, why does it always rain on the days when you don't bring your umbrella? Why is the line you don't join at Kroger always moving faster than the line that you do join? Why do you sometimes feel down even though you have no idea why? Why do people you love die younger or suffer inexplicable health issues while evil world dictators continue to thrive? If you're with me right now, if you're playing around with these ideas in your head, then you're feeling with me, Hebel, that life is elusive. And this gets so personal for us as well. I mean, you can pour yourself out for something, you can give yourself to something, you can invest in something, and it might succeed or not. Something in life can make all kinds of sense to you. I mean, it just makes perfect sense. This is the thing that needs to happen. But then the thing that happens is the opposite. How much control do you really have over whether your health is good or whether your job is secure? How much control do you really have over the interest rates or who you will meet next month or what you'll be doing in 15 years or 10 years or 5 years? How much control do you really have over the lives of your children and your teenagers? Life feels more like building a sandcastle near the ocean. I mean, you know, for maybe an hour or so, we're doing it, right? We're getting that castle up, and you got kids around you maybe, or grandkids, and it's looking pretty good, you know? But inevitably, the tide will come in. You can't hold the ocean back. Friends, sometimes we live like we think we can. Ecclesiastes reminds us, don't try. The life God has for you and for me begins when you accept this reality. You know, the Bible doesn't talk about sandcastles, but it does talk about grass and wind to make the same point. Listen to Psalm 103, verses 15 and 16. As for man, his days are like grass. He flourishes like a flower of the field, for the wind passes over it, and it is gone. And its place it knows no more. Of course, in our sinfulness, we act like this isn't true, like Adam and Eve in the garden trying to grasp at a sort of autonomy and self-sufficiency. We act like we will live forever. We will live in such a way where our lives kind of are built on not sand, but iron, steel, something hardy. We think we're in control. We walk around convinced that we can make a real difference in this world. And that's why we wake up and go to work each day. It's also why some people have a midlife crisis. They wonder what all that time and effort has actually accomplished. They get to a certain stage in their life. Usually it's 40s or 50s or something like that. You know, the midlife crisis is an expression of Hebel. If life was not a mere breath, if life was not a quick puff of smoke, then no one would ever have a midlife crisis. Verse 4 continues the same train of thought. Notice what is going on there. It says, one generation goes, another comes, but the earth remains forever. And the earth is a fixed thing. There's a permanence about the earth, but not human generations, according to the teacher Jerome, the great 5th century saint. He comments on this very verse. He says, you know, this is appalling. The earth, which was made for humans, stays, but humans themselves, the lords of the earth, suddenly dissolve into dust. People who ought to rule everything continually live and die, while the earth, which should be ruled, according to Genesis chapter 1, remains. One of the things I most enjoy when I gather with close family is hearing stories about past generations. So I'm gathering with my mom, and we've got my kids around and other maybe cousins, and we're talking about all these stories, all these fun stories, you know, serious stories about uncles who attempted to stage a coup, a political coup, and were thrown in jail, or humorous stories of eccentric relatives with reclusive lifestyles that rival Hugh Hefner. True stories. You have your own, I'm sure, as you sit around the table. But as much as we love to reminisce, one concrete fact remains. Generations come. And generations go. One day we will be chief characters in family stories told at kitchen tables and around fireplaces, but we will also be dead. Meanwhile, the earth remains. I still remember 4-year-old Sam, he's now 10, so this is years ago, 4-year-old Sam telling me after seeing a couple initial white whiskers, Dad, when did you become a grandpa? Josh recently, he's 7, he said, Dad, that's disgusting. Oh, what's disgusting, Josh? You have hair in your ear. It's like, oh, that's a wonderful new development for me. Just yesterday, I was a teen thinking that my parents are old. Now here I am talking to children who think I am old. You know, author Terry Pratchett, he wrote the Discworld series, if you're familiar with that. He once remarked, inside every old person is a young person wondering what in the world just happened. That is Hebel. So there's your first dose of smelling salt as we're working our way through this chapter. It's kind of shocking, isn't it, that this would be in the Bible and that we're invited into these feelings of Hebel. It's a good thing for you and me to experience what he is talking about here, and that this is the beginning of truly living for God. That is the implication if this is divine scripture. All right, so hang with me. Here's point number two. Life is circular. Life isn't only short and elusive. Life is also circular. It's repetitive. It's a merry-go-round. You know, one of the fun things about kids is that they are full of wonder. We were in Thailand just recently, as many of you know, and I was tossing around a little boy, and he kept saying, do it again, you know? Whether it's peekaboo or swinging kids around or flipping them around, it's all amazement to children, isn't it? Do it again. Do it again. Meanwhile, the adult gives up and tries to redirect that child to something more productive. One of the sad things about becoming an adult is that we lose this sense of wonder, don't we? Everything seems to get so old and monotonous. Maybe we should have joy in the monotony, but more often than not, we are bored. More often than not, we're even despairing of the same old. The teacher compares this feeling to what happens in the world. Notice verses 5-7. Every day the sun accomplishes the same mundane task. It rises and then it sets, but its work is never complete. Its task never ends. In fact, that verb there for hastens literally is to pant. It's like the sun is tired. The sun is weary from its never-ending, never-progressing work. Every day it gets up and it does the same thing. A lot of activity without very much progress. And it's not just the sun. Notice the wind, too, works hard. It blows all over the world, north and south and so forth. A lot of movement, but no destination. Streams and rivers are the same, flowing into larger bodies of water. You know, the teacher might have been picturing the Jordan River, which for thousands of years had been flowing into the landlocked Dead Sea. But it never fills up, does it? The longest river in the world, the Amazon in South America, has the most powerful water flow. It is greater than the next 7 largest rivers combined. In other words, the Amazon is the hardest working river on the planet. For thousands of years, it has been flowing into the Atlantic Ocean. And for thousands of years, the Atlantic Ocean hasn't gotten full. Never. Here again, we see another endless repetitive cycle of working hard with very little progress. The teacher's saying to us, this is life. According to verse 8, notice, it's all just weariness. Our eyes take in sights, our ears hear sounds, we speak words. But friends, we are never satisfied. Today, we live in this visual media culture where our eyes and our ears are bombarded with powerful stimuli. With Facebook and iPads and Netflix, we have quick access to a lot of things that can stimulate our senses. But it's never enough, is it? We're always back for another tweet or another quick peek at Instagram or another movie. We're always looking for the next great television series to give ourselves to. What are we going to do when Severance or Silo or whatever you're watching wraps up? Our eyes and our ears are never satisfied. They want more. This is the Hebel life. The teacher then makes the startling statement. Notice verses 9 and 10. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Can one say about anything, look, this is new? It has already existed in the ages before us. Do you ever wonder whether the things you're building in life, the things that you're investing in life, whether those things really matter? Do you ever feel like you're just kind of going through the motions of life? Your wheels are spinning 100 miles an hour. You're doing lots of things, almost like you're living on a hamster wheel. But who knows if any of the stuff you're doing and investing in, whether it actually matters. Think about all the mundane things we do every single day. You know, we get up, we take a shower, brush our teeth, we eat, we maybe go to school or work, and there's emails, there's endless work, there's diapers or laundry or other things. In the evening, we're home with our families, we're around a table, we eat and we put our kids to bed perhaps. Maybe there's a show we watch or there's a book we enjoy. And then guess what's waiting for us tomorrow? The same thing. The same, often exact thing. And so, of course, we wonder, am I getting anywhere? Am I making a dent? Am I making progress with life? Day after day, year after year, it's the same old. Now, you might say to me, well, Pastor, what about the internet or smartphones or some new tech that comes up, you know, next week or next month? Now, all that stuff just moves information faster, but it's still the same information. It may entertain you faster, but it's still the same entertainment. And have any of those gadgets made your life better? Have they mitigated the pain of Hebel? Not really. In fact, statistics say that people in America are less satisfied today than they were 20 or 50 years ago. The so-called new tech just accentuates the reality of Hebel. There really is nothing new under the sun. Not only is there, notice, nothing new, but according to verse 11, we read there's nothing remembered. Nothing new, nothing remembered. Talk about a downer. This whole thing, we're kind of, we're sinking, right? It feels a little bit like that. I mean, the level of cynicism and despair is at an all-time high, or it feels like that. Well, let's keep moving, and hopefully I can help you a little bit. Not only, we got to start cynical, not only will you be forgotten, but according to the teacher, your kids and your grandkids and your great-grandkids, no one's going to remember them either. Think about this for a second, okay? Let's do a little thought experiment. How many of you can remember the first and last names of your great-grandparents? Raise your hand. That's amazing. Good job. Okay, just a couple over here. Good job. Four or five over here. My hand is definitely not raised. Oh, my goodness. Partly because Sri Lankan names are very difficult, okay? But that's not the only reason. You know, in 100 years, if Jesus tarries, your relatives likely won't remember your name. Life is short. Death is coming. We are forgotten. So again, some smelling salts at work, waking us up. But we don't want to think about this, do we? Pastor, talk about something else. You know, can you give me some comfort today? I wasn't expecting this when I came to church. I mean, I drove through the snow and I want some hope. I want some joy. Well, here's the surprise of Ecclesiastes. The surprise of Ecclesiastes is that comfort and hope and joy, a profound level of those things, comes to us when we first face this reality. Okay? I know our tendency is to ignore this. It's to cover it up, to sweep it under the rug, to hide it in the closet. The world certainly tries to do that as well. But our God wisely speaks through Ecclesiastes to us today. Our tendency is not only to ignore this. The other tendency, I think, is to pour ourselves out to try to gain lasting significance, to pull significance out of this life. So if I run hard on the hamster wheel of life, you know, I can make a dent. I can find significance and joy and hope in my maybe career or my friendships or my family. I can build monuments that can help me feel significant. Well, friends, when you come to the end of your life, what will you point to that will give you a real sense of significance? Will it be something you accomplished? God is speaking to us through Ecclesiastes this morning. He's reminding us that this life isn't designed to give us ultimate significance. And so any kind of striving in this world for ultimate reality, for ultimate identity, it's going to fail you. And here's the hope. Once you recognize that, you can begin to enjoy the blessing of this life as God intended. I heard a story recently about a boy with a toy truck. He's playing with his truck. He's driving around the floor. His dad's watching. And then all of a sudden, he tosses this truck, and then he starts to cry. He grabs that truck, and he does it again. He plays with it on the floor, and then he tosses it, and he starts to cry. And the dad's trying to figure out, like, what is going on? Well, the kid was hoping the truck could fly. The dad tried to explain to him, listen, kid, like, you're frustrated with the truck because you're trying to get it to do something that it was never designed to do. Well, friends, the same thing is true of life under the sun. Don't try to squeeze out of this life something that it was never designed to give you. And if you do, you'll be so frustrated with this life. You and I both experience that, right? But if we can learn to accept the Hebel existence, because it's the true existence, well, then I think we're on to something. Let me close with two applications. I want to close with two applications. Here's the first one. Learn to enjoy the rhythms of life. Learn to enjoy the rhythms of life. Now, I know your tendency and my tendency is to escape the rhythms of life. Get past that drudgery. Look for something new. Look for, you know, that bright, shiny object. By the way, that's why people have affairs. That's why people make rash decisions and take foolish turns away from Jesus. Lewis's Screwtape Letters makes the same point here in this quote. Senior demon Screwtape offers his nephew Wormwood this advice. Listen carefully. The horror of the same old thing is one of the most valuable passions we have produced in the human heart. An endless source of heresies in religion, folly in counsel, infidelity in marriage, and inconstancy in friendship. But friends, what if there was a greater pleasure to be found in the repetitive rhythms of life? What if within the same old life and the same old spouse and the same old family and the same old school is embedded the very blessing of God? What if in those very realities and those rhythms, God has purposed to bless you and me with a deeper and more profound joy? If you just give yourself to it. Listen, friends, we have to retool our minds so that we can enjoy the normal, repetitive things of life. We have to retrain ourselves to sense the extraordinary value in a repeating life. Well, let me give you some examples. What if we looked at daily meals, not as a way to network or impress or refuel, but just to enjoy good food and good people? What if we looked at the few and fleeting years we have with our children, not as a way to mold them into something or kind of prop them up as impressive specimens, all kinds of pressure with that, right? But rather to simply enjoy them as God's good gifts to us for as long as he would have them with us. What if students here could look at their classes, not as means to just a diploma and a career and money and so forth, but as means to enjoying knowledge and delighting in God's created world and order and just this wonderful history of humanity that he has written for us? What if you thought about your job not as a way to promote yourself and, you know, build yourself up or build your resume up, but as a way rather to glorify God with your skill? What if you could think about your marriage relationship not as a means to fulfilling your own interests, but as a way to grow into greater Christ-likeness? What if we could look at gathering with this church week after week, month after month? We got the chosen frozen here, right? Frozen chosen, excuse me. What if we could look at gathering with the church not as drudgery, not as a way of making a name for ourselves, but an opportunity to enjoy being with God's people in the presence of God? What if we could look at our weekly liturgy and the singing and the songs and so forth, not as rote, not as kind of going through the same old motions, but as another opportunity? Oh, we need this, don't we? Another opportunity to be discipled in the rhythms of the gospel. I need that more than just once a week, but certainly with you on Sundays. What if we can squeeze out of this life what God intends, such that the everyday rhythms of life become an incomparable delight to us? Well, then maybe we could recover the wonder of a child and pray to God each morning, asking him eagerly to do it again. Do it again, Lord. Do it again. You know, the crazy thing is that understanding what this life is and what this life isn't are the first steps to turning to Jesus. Once you grasp that ultimate significance isn't found in this life, you are well on your way to understanding that ultimate significance is found exclusively, gloriously, beautifully in Christ. And that brings us to our final application. Here it is. Rejoice that Jesus makes all things new. All things. For Solomon, who wrote Ecclesiastes, death wields an unbroken dominion over humans. We cannot escape it. But Solomon didn't know something that we know. He didn't know that death's grip on humanity would break when Jesus rose from the dead. Solomon saw unending drudgery. We see the cycle breaking with Jesus. You know, the earth may operate in unending cycles without lasting progress. Our lives may operate in unending cycles without lasting progress or without remembrance. But Jesus steps onto the scene. He interrupts all of the madness that's going on. And he does something new. And friends, his work is permanent work. His work will be remembered. Where do we see this? Well, let's put Revelation 5 right alongside Ecclesiastes chapter 1 for just a moment. We studied this last year, so hopefully you can kind of pull up some of the vision and scenes from that wonderful chapter. In that chapter, we see the Lamb, Jesus, who was slain for sinners, the only one worthy to take that scroll of redemptive history and complete the work God has to save a people and redeem a world for himself. Friends, Jesus' work is permanent. It lasts. You know, it doesn't kind of lose steam. It doesn't fizzle out. It doesn't rot. It cannot be undone in you, in me, in this church. And it will certainly be remembered for centuries and millennia and ages to come. Listen, friends, choirs of angels and the four living creatures and the elders and the church made up of every tongue, tribe, and nation, and eventually all of creation will sing and shout for all eternity about the glories of Jesus' everlasting new work. What is that work? It's a new world for his people. And by the way, isn't absent of rhythms, but rather a new world filled with new rhythms given to new people. So today, brothers and sisters, even as we navigate this life of Hebel, as we step into the same old of this upcoming week, we step into it with a new vision for enjoying God's blessings within it. We step into it with a deep recognition that Jesus has come, that Jesus will come with the promise of newness. Amen. Let's take a moment now to ponder the passage to prepare our hearts for the Lord's Supper.